Nicharanamrita, we chant Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda, like that. So there's something we chant before we read the Krishna book. And you could all chant it along with me. Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 Rakshaman. Krishna, 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 Pahimam. Rama Raghava, Rama Raghava, Rama Raghava, Rakshamam. Krishna Keshava, Krishna Keshava, Krishna Keshava, Pahimam. So that's actually from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhulila, Chapter 7, Text 96. Lord Chaitanya used to chant that as he was walking along the road when he was going from one place to the other. Okay, so we're reading from the Krishna book, and I want to read a few. Nope. That was the Jayarada Madhava for the Krishna book. Yes. No. We're reading from the Krishna book. That's... Yeah, that's why I made the point. When we chant, read from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we don't chant Jaya Radhama generally. We just chant Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda. And this is since I joined in the middle of April 1973, before we read from the Krishna book, this is what we did. Okay? Thank you. So there's a few places here where, just to get everybody kind of enthused and inspired about the benefit of reading the Krishna book, I'd like to read a few things that Prabhupada says about that. So in the preface to the Krishna book, Prabhupada says, "This book, Krishna, is another presentation to help the Krishna consciousness movement in the Western world. This transcendental literature is published with profuse illustrations. People love to read various kinds of fiction to spend their time and energy. Now this tendency can be directed to Krishna. The result will be the imperishable satisfaction of the soul, both individually and collectively. One will find that by reading one page after another, an immense treasure of knowledge in art, science, literature, philosophy, and religion will be revealed. And ultimately, by reading this one book, Krishna, love of Godhead will fructify." So that's one. And there's another little place here in the chapter called Uddhava Visits Vrindavan, where Prabhupada talks about the importance of reading Krishna book. He says, okay. "Lila Smarana is the process of association with Krishna most recommended by great devotees. Even Lord Chaitanya, when he was at Puri, enjoyed Lila Smarana association with Krishna. Those in the most exalted position of devotional service and ecstasy can live with Krishna always by remembering his pastimes. Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur has given us a transcendental literature called Krishna Bhavanamrita, which is full with Krishna's pastimes. Exalted devotees can remain absorbed in Krishna thought by reading such books. Any book of Krishna Lila, even this book, Krishna, or our teachings of Lord Chaitanya, is actually solace for the devotees feeling separation from Krishna." And finally, right towards the end of the Krishna book, in the chapter called The Summary Description of Lord Krishna's Pastimes, Prabhupada says about the importance of reading Krishna book, he says, "Following in the footsteps of Srila Sukadeva Goswami, we have tried to present this book, Krishna, for being read and heard by the conditioned souls of this age. By hearing the pastimes of Lord Krishna, one is sure and certain to get salvation and be transferred back home, back to Godhead. It is stated by Sukadeva Goswami that as we hear the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, we gradually cut the knots of material contamination. Therefore, regardless of what one is, if one wants the association of Lord Krishna in the transcendental kingdom of God for eternity in blissful existence, one must hear about the pastimes of Lord Krishna and chant the Maha Mantra." Let's teen a little bit more here. It says, "The transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna are so powerful that simply by hearing, reading, and memorizing this book, Krishna, one is sure to be transferred to the spiritual world, which is ordinarily very difficult to achieve." And it goes on, but that's the gist of it. So very important to read the Krishna book, and very beneficial. So we're going to start with chapter 1. Which is entitled The Advent of Lord Krishna. Okay. Okay. Once the world was overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings, who were actually demons, but were posing themselves as the royal order. So, as I said right at the beginning, mostly I'm just going to be reading, but I do want to interject a couple little things right here because I've got something that's pretty relevant that'll help us and enhance our appreciation of what's being explained here. Okay, so how did that come to be, that the world was overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings who were actually demons, posing themselves as the royal order? So I've got some insight into this from a book that was written by Sariputta Das called Alien Identities. But in one part, he talks about the Mahabharata. And he quotes from the Mahabharata. This is Vyasadeva talking to King Janamejaya. He says, "O best of monarchs, just as humankind was flourishing, powerful and demoniac creatures began to take birth from the wives of earthly kings. Once the godly adichas who administer the universe fought their wicked cousins, the daichas, and vanquished them. Bereft of their power and positions, the daichas began to take birth on this planet, having carefully calculated that they could easily become the gods of the earth." This is from the Mahabharata I'm reading. "Bringing it under their demoniac rule. And thus it happened, O mighty one, that the asuras began to appear among different creatures and communities." So this is the explanation of how the earth had become overburdened by the unnecessary defense force of different kings who were actually demons posing themselves as the royal order. And here's some further insight to it. "The technique adopted by the invading forces was to enter in their subtle bodies into the wombs of the wives of the kings and thereby take birth in the royal families. In this way, they seized control of earthly governments and were able to exploit the earth as they liked." They won the war without even having to fire a shot. That was pretty clever. They just took birth in the wombs of the wives of the earthly kings, and they became the kings, and they took over like that. Goes on to say here, and it's pretty much it. "As the demoniac creatures continued to take birth on the earth herself could not bear the weight of their presence," and we're going to hear that. "Having fallen from their positions in the higher planets, the sons of Diti and Danu thus appeared in this world as monarchs endowed with great strength and in many other forms." So the many other forms are Putana, Bakasura, Agasura, you know, Vatsasura, all those asuras. They're the many other forms, right? "They were bold and haughty, and they virtually surrounded the water-bounded earth, ready to crush those who would oppose them. They harassed the teachers, rulers, merchants, and workers of the earth, and all other creatures. Moving about by the hundreds and thousands, they began to slay the earth's creatures, and they brought terror to the world. Unconcerned with godly culture of the Brahmins, they threatened the sages who sat peacefully in their forest ashrams, for the so-called kings were maddened by the strength of their bodies." So, some further insight into what we're hearing. And then, the rest we could just hear from the Krishna book. So it goes on. "At that time, the whole world became perturbed, and the predominating deity of this earth, known as Bhumi, went to see Lord Brahma to tell of her calamities due to the demoniac kings. Bhumi assumed the shape of a cow and presented herself before Lord Brahma with tears in her eyes. She was bereaved and was weeping just to invoke the Lord's compassion. She related the calamitous position of the earth. And after hearing this, Lord Brahma became much aggrieved, and he at once started for the ocean of milk, where Lord Vishnu resides. Lord Brahma was accompanied by all the demigods, headed by Lord Shiva, and Bhumi also followed. Arriving on the shore of the milk ocean, Lord Brahma began to pacify Lord Vishnu, who had formerly saved the earthly planet by assuming the transcendental form of a boar. In the Vedic mantras, there is a particular type of prayer called Purusha Shukta. Generally, the demigods offer their obeisances unto Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by chanting the Purusha Shukta. It is understood herein that the predominating deity of every planet can see the Supreme Lord of this universe. Brahma, whenever there is some disturbance on this planet, It is understood herein that the predominating deity of every planet can see the Supreme Lord of this universe, Brahma, whenever there is some disturbance on his planet. And Brahma can approach the Supreme Lord Vishnu, not by seeing him directly, but by standing on the shore of the ocean of milk, period. Okay. There is a planet within this universe called Swetadweep, and on that planet there is an ocean of milk. It is understood from various Vedic literatures that just as there is the ocean of salt water on this planet, there are various kinds of oceans on other planets. Somewhere there is an ocean of milk. Somewhere there is an ocean of oil. Somewhere there are oceans of liquor and many other types of liquids. The Purusha Shukta is the standard prayer which the demigods recite to appease the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Shiradakshai Vishnu. Because he is lying on the ocean of milk, he is called Shiradakshai Vishnu. Shira means milk. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, through whom all the incarnations within this universe appear. So just one teeny comment here. You know, you might hear something like this, ocean of milk, ocean of salt water, ocean of ghee, ocean, you know, how is this possible? Well, why not? You know, why not? In other words, these are details of a part of a description of a particular worldview. The predominating worldview today is that the origin of everything is the absence of knowledge, the absence of organized form, and the absence of any kind of experience. Why should we accept that worldview? I mean, it doesn't tally up with my immediate experience. I mean, look here. This book, this table, this here, these cards of everything within our experience in you know, human life, there's knowledge, there's intent in producing it, and there's talent and abilities. So why jump to another explanation? What's wrong with that explanation for the ultimate origin of everything? That the ultimate origin of everything is the presence of an eternal form of blissful knowledge. And that's what we accept as an axiomatic truth. That's us. That makes perfect sense to me. Why do I have to accept the absence of knowledge, the absence of organized form, the absence of any kind of experience as the ultimate origin of everything? Why not the presence of knowledge, the presence of an eternal form of positive, blissful experience? That's Krishna consciousness, and these are some of the details of that worldview. You know, the beginning is not a vacuum. It's a plenum. Vacuum means nothing. Plenum means everything. Anyway, that's one little comment there. Okay, so reading on. After all the demigods offered the Purusha Shukta prayer to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they apparently heard no response. Then Lord Brahma personally sat in meditation, and there was a message transmission from Lord Vishnu to Brahma. Brahma then broadcast the message to the demigods. That is the system of receiving Vedic knowledge. The Vedic knowledge is received first by Brahma from the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the medium of the heart, period. As stated in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, Tene Brahma Rida Yadadi Kavaye, the transcendental knowledge of the Vedas was transmitted to Lord Brahma through the heart. Here also, in the same way, only Brahma could understand the message transmitted by Lord Vishnu, and he broadcast it to the demigods for their immediate action. I think that's kind of an important point there, that only Brahma could understand the message transmitted by Lord Vishnu. So he was qualified, and even the demigods weren't qualified to understand it through the heart. They had to hear it from Lord Brahma. So we have to, in our attempt to advance in devotional service, understand that we have to hear from the parampara. We shouldn't be expecting. You know, Krishna does say in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that to those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. But we shouldn't necessarily take that as meaning dictation by Krishna from within the heart, although that could be the case if somebody becomes advanced enough. But you hear from the advanced devotees. You hear from the acharyas in the parampara disciplic succession. Lord Brahma was qualified directly here from Krishna Vishnu within his heart, but these other demigods weren't, and, you know, maybe we're not either. So just a thought. Okay, so reading on. The message was this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead would appear on the earth very soon, along with his supreme powerful potencies. And as long as he remained on the earth planet, to execute his mission of annihilating the demons and establishing the devotees, the demigods should also remain there to assist him. They should all immediately take birth in the family of the Yadu dynasty, wherein the Lord would also appear in due course of time. So in other words, the demigods and Krishna are not going to take that what's happening lying down. Okay, you know, they're aware. The demons have all taken birth and they're with the intention of taking over the earth. And Bhumi has become aware of that. So she goes to Lord Brahma and explains to him, hey, we got a problem. And then Lord Brahma goes to Lord Vishnu and they got a plan. They have a plan how they're going to counteract what the demons are trying to do. So it goes on. The Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, Krishna, would personally appear as the son of Vasudev. Before his appearance, all the demigods, along with their wives, should appear in different pious families in the world just to assist the Lord in executing his mission. The exact word used here is tat priyartam, which means the demigods should appear on the earth in order to please the Lord. In other words, any living entity who lives only to satisfy the Lord is a demigod. The demigods were further informed that the plenary portion of Lord Krishna Ananta, who is maintaining the universal planets by extending his millions of hoods, would also appear on earth before Lord Krishna's appearance. They were also informed that the external potency of Vishnu, Maya, with whom all the conditioned souls are enamored, would also appear by the order of the Supreme Lord just to execute his purpose. So it seems like, as I said, Krishna's not taking this lying down, and they really basically they got a whole all-star team that's going to come here. After instructing and pacifying all the demigods as well as Bhumi with sweet words, Lord Brahma, the father of all prajapatis or progenitors of the universal population, that's what a prajapati is, a progenitor of the universal population, departed for his abode, the highest material planet called Brahmaloka. The leader of the Yadu dynasty, King Shurasena, was ruling over the country known as Mathura, wherein lies the city of Mathura. As well as the district known as Shurasena, which was named after him. On account of the rule of King Shurasena, Mathura became the capital city of all the kings of the Yadus. Mathura was also made the capital of the kings of the Yadu dynasty because the Yadus were a very pious family and knew that Mathura is the place where Lord Sri Krishna lives eternally, just as he lives in Dwarka. Once upon a time, Vasudev, the son of Shurasena, just after marrying Devaki, was going home on his chariot with his newly wedded wife. The father of Devaki, known as Devaka, had contributed a sufficient dowry because he was very affectionate toward his daughter. He had contributed hundreds of chariots completely decorated with gold equipment, period. At that time, the reason I say period, sometimes I'm not familiar with this, so I'm reading it. I'm not, anyway, just so you know, get the right emphasis. At that time, Kamsa, the son of Ugrasen, in order to please his sister Devaki, had voluntarily taken the reins of the horses of Vasudev's chariot, and was driving. According to the custom of the Vedic civilization, when a girl is married, the brother takes his sister and brother-in-law to their home, because the newly married girl may feel too much separation from her father's family. The brother goes with her until she reaches her father-in-law's house. The full dowry contributed by Devaka was as follows. 400 elephants fully decorated with golden garlands, 15,000 decorated horses, 1,800 chariots. He also arranged for 200 beautiful girls to follow his daughter, period. The Kshatriya system of marriage still current in India dictates that when a Kshatriya is married, a few dozen of the bride's young girlfriends, in addition to the bride, go to the house of the king. The followers of the queen are called maidservants, but actually they act as friends of the queen. This practice is prevalent from time immemorial, traceable at least to the time before the advent of Lord Krishna 5,000 years ago. So Vasudev brought home another 200 beautiful girls along with his wife Devaki. While the bride and bridegroom were passing along on the chariot, there were different kinds of musical instruments playing to indicate the auspicious moment. There were conch shells, bugles, drums, and kettle drums combined together. They were vibrating a nice concert. The procession was passing very pleasingly, and Kamsa was driving the chariot, when suddenly there was a miraculous sound vibrated from the sky, which especially announced to Kamsa, "Kamsa, you are such a fool. You are driving the chariot of your sister and your brother-in-law, but you do not know that the eighth child of this sister will kill you." Kamsa was the son of Ugrasen of the Bhoja dynasty. It is said that Kamsa was the most demoniac of all the Bhoja dynasty kings. Immediately after hearing the prophecy from the sky, he caught hold of Devaki's hair and was just about to kill her with his sword. Vasudev was astonished at Kamsa's behavior, and in order to pacify the cruel, shameless brother-in-law, he began to speak as follows. With great reason and evidence, he said, "My dear brother-in-law Kamsa, you are the most famous king of the Bhoja dynasty, and people know that you are the greatest warrior and a valiant king. How is it that you are so infuriated that you are prepared to kill a woman who is your own sister at this auspicious time of her marriage?" Okay, so he's saying that she's Kamsa's sister, but we just heard that Devaki is the daughter of Devaka, and Kamsa is the son of Ugrasena. So how are they brother and sister? Well, the only thing I could come up with was maybe there's a relationship between Ugrasena and Devaka, because sometimes Krishna and Arjuna are referred to as brothers. You know, now they have this thing of cousin brother in the Veda culture. It's when if the relationship's really close like that, they refer to it as brother and sister. It's not technically that, but you know, so technically, according to this, Kamsa is not the brother of Devaki, because his father is Ugrasena and Devaki's father is Devaka, and Devaka and Ugrasena not the same person. But anyway, it might be what we'd have to do some research. That makes sense. Okay, so how is it that you? Okay, I read that. Why should you be so much afraid of death? Death is already born along with your birth. From the very day you took your birth, you began to die. Suppose you are 25 years old. That means you have already died 25 years. Every moment, every second, you are dying. Why then should you be so much afraid of death? Final death is inevitable. You may die either today or in 100 years. You cannot avoid death. Why should you be so much afraid? Actually, death means annihilation of the present body. As soon as the present body stops functioning and mixes with the five elements of material nature, the living entity within the body accepts another body according to his present action and reaction. It is just like when a man walks on the street. He puts forward his foot, and when he is confident that his foot is situated on sound ground, he lifts the other foot. In this way, one after another, the bodies change and the soul transmigrates. See how the plant worm changes from one twig to another so carefully. Similarly, the living entity changes his body as soon as the higher authorities decide on his next body. As long as the living entity is conditioned within this material world, he must take material bodies one after another. His next particular body is offered by the laws of nature according to the actions and reactions of his life. Okay, so bear in mind that, you know, Vasudev is saying all this. You know, when Kamsa is right on the verge of killing his bride, you got to kind of think about the incredible composure. You know, he's in a very difficult situation. You know, Kamsa is just about to take. He took out his sword, actually. He was wanting to, you know, kill Devakin, he's able to, you know, stay cool and preach this amazing philosophy, you know, so expertly. He's quite an amazing person. So it goes on to say, this body is exactly like one of the bodies which we always see in dreams. During our dream of sleep, we create so many bodies according to mental creation. We have seen gold and we have seen a mountain. So in a dream, we can see a golden mountain by combining the two ideas. Sometimes in dreams, we see that we have a body which is flying in the sky. At that time, we completely forget our present body. Similarly, these bodies are changing. When you have one body, you forget the past body. During a dream, we may make contact with so many new kinds of bodies. But when we are awake, we forget them all. And actually, these material bodies are the creations of our mental activities. But at the present moment, we do not recollect our past bodies. He goes on. The nature of the mind is flickering. Sometimes it accepts something and immediately it rejects the same thing. Accepting and rejecting is the process of the mind in contact with the five objects of sense gratification, form, taste, smell, sound, and touch. In a speculative way, the mind comes in touch with the objects of sense gratification. And when the living entity desires a particular type of body, he gets it. Therefore, the body is an offering by the laws of material nature. The living entity accepts a body and comes out again into the material world to enjoy or suffer according to the construction of the body. Unless we have a particular type of body, we cannot enjoy or suffer according to our mental proclivities inherited from the previous life. The particular type of body is actually offered to us according to our mental condition at the time of death. The luminous planets like the sun, moon, or stars reflect themselves in different types of reservoirs like water, oil, or ghee. The reflection moves according to the movement of the reservoir. The reflection of the moon is on the water, and the moving water makes the moon also appear to be moving. But actually, the moon is not moving. Similarly, by mental concoction, the living entity attains different kinds of bodies, although actually he has no connection with such bodies. But on account of illusion, being enchanted by the influence of Maya, the living entity thinks that he belongs to a particular type of body. That is the way of conditioned life. I can think of another example that probably everybody's seen this. You have sometimes on a cloudy day, the moon is up, and the clouds are being, you know, it's windy, and the clouds are being blown. It looks like the moon is racing through the clouds. Has anybody ever seen that? I've seen it a lot because I kind of try to go out and watch the sunrise. But it looks like the moon is racing through the clouds. Actually, the moon is not doing nothing. The moon's right there. It doesn't move an inch. It's just the clouds that are zipping by like that. And the moon is like, you know, a quarter of a million miles, according to the scientists anyway, it's a quarter of a million miles out there. The clouds are maybe just like a mile or so above, you know. But the appearance is, oh, look at the moon is racing through the clouds. Nothing to do with that. It's totally illusion. So in the same way, you know, we're identifying with these bodies, but then really nothing to do with who we really are. Anyway, reading on. That is the way of conditioned life. Suppose the living entity is now in a human form of body. He thinks that he belongs to the human community or a particular country or particular place. He identifies himself in that way and unnecessarily prepares for another body, which is not required by him. Such desires and mental concoctions are the cause of different types of bodies. The covering influence of the material nature is so strong that the living entity is satisfied in whatever body he gets. That's an important thing right there. The covering influence of the material nature is so strong, very strong. In other words, when Krishna is going to create an illusion, he does a good job. He does a good job, you know, and that's, you know. So it goes on. Therefore, I beg to request you not to be overwhelmed by the dictation of your mind and body. Vasudeva thus requested Kamsa not to be envious of his newly married sister. One should not be envious of anyone because envy is the cause of fear, both in this world and in the next. When one is before Yamaraj, the lord of punishment after death, period. Vasudeva appealed to Kamsa on behalf of Devaki, stating that she was his younger sister. He also appealed at an auspicious moment at the time of marriage. A younger sister or brother is supposed to be protected as one's child. The position is overall so delicate, Vasudeva reasoned. He's thinking to himself. He's not saying that to Kamsa. That if you kill her, it will go against your high reputation. Oh, no, maybe he is saying that to Kamsa. Yeah, he is saying that to Kamsa. The position is overall so delicate, Vasudev reasoned out loud, that if you kill her, he's talking to Kamsa, it will go against your high reputation. In this way, Vasudev tried to pacify Kamsa by good instruction, as well as by philosophical discrimination. But Kamsa was not to be pacified because of his association, because his association was demoniac. Because of his demoniac associations, he was a demon, although born in a very high royal family. A demon never cares for any good instruction. He is just like a determined thief. One can give him moral instruction, but it will not be effective. Similarly, those who are demoniac or atheistic by nature can hardly assimilate any good instruction, however authorized it may be. That is the difference between demigod and demon. Those who cannot accept good instruction and try to live their lives in that way are called, those who can accept good instruction and try to live their lives in that way are called demigods. And those who are unable to take such good instruction are called demons. Failing in his attempt to pacify Kamsa, Vasudev wondered how he could protect his wife, Devaki. When there is imminent danger, an intelligent person should try to avoid the dangerous position as far as possible. But if in spite of endeavoring by all intelligence, one fails to avoid the dangerous position, there is no fault on his part. One should try his best to execute his duties, but if his attempt fails, he is not at fault. Vasudev thought of his wife as follows. For the present, let me save the life of Devaki. Then later on, if there are children, I shall see how to save them. So he's a very smart person. I mean, he just gave an amazing, lecture to Kamsa, presented the philosophy super expertly, right? In a very, difficult situation. Didn't work because Kamsa's such a full-on demon, right? But now he's got he's come up with another plan. He's got plan B. Oh, let's try plan B. And this is plan B. He further thought, if in the future I get a child that can kill Kamsa, just as Kamsa is thinking, then both Devaki and the child will be saved because the law of providence is inconceivable. But now, some way or other, let me save the life of Devaki. There is no certainty how a living entity contacts a certain type of body, just as there is no certainty how a blazing fire comes in contact with a certain type of wood in the forest. When there is a forest fire, it is experienced that the blazing fire sometimes leaps over one tree and catches another by the influence of the wind. Similarly, a living entity may be very careful in the matter of executing his duties, but it is still very difficult for him to know what type of body he's going to get in his next life. I had a little realization about that. Years ago, I was living in Australia, and I was on a program where we were trying to sell full sets of books. And I remember we visited this one place in Perth, or maybe it was Adelaide Hills, and they had fires, And we were visiting somebody, and they were right in this neighborhood where a lot of houses were burned down. And he was describing to us exactly what we just heard here, that the fire would burn one house, and then it just totally skipped the house he was in, jumped over and burned the house next to him. So, you can't tell. You can't predict. It's not like the fire, this one, then that one, then this. No, it's burning here, and then the wind blows, and the fire shoots over to some house 100 yards away, burns that one down. And, so it's like that. So I had firsthand experience of what's being described here. Maharaj Bharat was very faithfully executing the duties of self-realization, but by chance he developed temporary affection for a deer. In his next life, he had to accept the body of a deer. Vasudev, after deliberating how to save his wife, began to speak to Kamsa with great respect, although Kamsa was the most sinful man. Sometimes it happens that a most virtuous person like Vasudev has to flatter a person like Kamsa, a most vicious person. That is the way of all diplomatic transactions. Although Vasudev was deeply aggrieved, he smiled outwardly. He's really a great, very intelligent and good diplomat and politician. He addressed the shameless Kamsa in that way because he was so atrocious. Vasudev said to Kamsa, "My dear brother-in-law, please consider that you have no danger from your sister. You are awaiting some danger because you have heard a prophetic voice in the sky, But the danger is to come from the sons of your sister who are not present now. And who knows? There may or may not be sons in the future. Considering all this, you are safe for the present. Nor is there cause for fear from your sister. If there are any sons born of her, I promise that I shall present all of them to you for necessary action. So this is plan B you're hearing right now. So then it says, Kamsa knew the value of Vasudev's word of honor, and he was convinced by his argument. For the time being, he desisted from the heinous killing of his sister. Thus, Vasudev was pleased and praised the decision of Kamsa. In this way, he returned to his home. Right? Okay, it goes on. How much more do we have? I'll try to finish the chapter. Yeah, you can do it. Each year thereafter, in due course of time, Devaki gave birth to a child. Thus, she gave birth to 8 male children, as well as one daughter. When the first son was born, Vasudev kept his word of honor and immediately brought the child before Kamsa. It is said that Vasudev was very much elevated and famous for his word of honor, and he wanted to maintain his fame. Although it was very painful for Vasudev to hand over the newly born child, Kamsa was very glad to receive him. But he became a little compassionate with the behavior of Vasudev. This event is very exemplary. For a great soul like Vasudev, there is nothing considered to be painful in the course of discharging one's duty. A learned person like Vasudev carries out his duties without hesitation. On the other hand, a demon like Kamsa never hesitates in committing any abominable action. It is said, therefore, that a saintly person can tolerate all kinds of miserable conditions of life, and a learned man can discharge his duties without awaiting favorable circumstances. A heinous person like Kamsa can act in any sinful way, and a devotee can sacrifice everything to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay, 2 more pages left. How are we doing for time? Good. All right, so we can do it. Kamsa became satisfied by the action of Vasudev. He was surprised to see Vasudev keeping his promise and being compassionate upon him, and pleased, he began to speak as follows. My dear Vasudev, you need not present this child to me. I am not in danger from this child. I have heard that the 8th child born of you and Devaki will kill me. Why should I accept this child unnecessarily? You can take him back. When Vasudev was returning home with his firstborn child, although he was pleased by the behavior of Kamsa, he could not believe in him because he knew that Kamsa was uncontrolled. An atheistic person cannot be firm in his word of honor. One who cannot control the senses cannot be steady in his determination. The great politician Chanakya Pandit said, "Never put your trust in a diplomat. Those who are addicted to unrestricted sense gratification can never be truthful, nor can they be trusted with any faith." At that time, the great sage Narada came to Kamsa. Okay, so Narada Muni is coming into the picture here. At that time, the great sage Narada came to Kamsa. He was informed of Kamsa's becoming compassionate to Vasudev and returning his firstborn child. Narada was eager to accelerate the descent of Lord Krishna as soon as possible. He therefore informed Kamsa that in Vrindavan, personalities like Nanda Maharaj and all other cowherd men and their wives, and on the other side, Vasudev, his father Surasena, and all his relatives born in the family of Vrishni of the Yadav dynasty, along with all their friends and well-wishers, were actually demigods. Hey, whose side is he on? Narada warned Kamsa to be careful of them, since Kamsa was his friend and advisors. Since Kamsa and his friends and advisors were all demons. Demons are always afraid of demigods. After being thus informed by Narada about the appearance of the demigods in different families, Kamsa at once became very much alarmed. He understood that since the demigods had already appeared, Lord Vishnu must be coming soon. He at once arrested both his brother-in-law, Vasudev, and Devaki, and put them behind prison bars. Within the prison, shackled in iron chains, Vasudev and Devaki gave birth to a male child year after year, and Kamsa, thinking each of the babies to be the incarnation of Vishnu, killed them one after another. He was particularly afraid of the 8th child, but after the visit of Narada, he came to the conclusion that any child might be Krishna. Therefore, it was better to kill all the babies who took birth from Devaki and Vasudev. This action of Kamsa is not difficult, very difficult to understand. There are many instances in the history of the world of persons in the royal order who have killed their father, brother, or whole family and friends for the satisfaction of their ambitions. There is nothing astonishing about this. For members of the demoniac, a greedy royal order can kill anyone for their nefarious ambitions. Kamsa was made aware of his previous birth by the grace of Narada. He learned that in his previous birth, he had been a demon of the name Kalanini, and that he had been killed by Vishnu. Having now taken his birth in the Bhoja family, he decided to become the deadly enemy of the Yadu dynasty. Krishna was going to take birth in that family, and Kamsa was very much afraid that he would be killed by Krishna, just as he had been killed in his last birth. He first of all imprisoned his father, Ugrasena, because he was the chief king of the Yadu, Bhoja, and Anhaka dynasties. He also occupied the kingdom of Shurasena, Vasudeva's father. He declared himself the king of all such places. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the first chapter of Krishna, the advent of Lord Krishna. Anybody have anything they'd like to say? Yeah, Rabindranath.
Yeah, you were reading about, it was a quotation from Chanakya Pandit, and as you say that never trust a politician, but you also forgot the other part of that, what it says there. It seemed like you just skipped over it. You didn't? Okay, I guess we just didn't hear back in the Bajari room. Okay.
Anybody else have anything they want to say? Does somebody else want to say anything? Okay, Sachin.
Prabhupada, thank you very much. At the beginning, you were mentioning about the whole story is about Mother Bhumi, the earth, going to Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu gave the order that, yes, because the earth is being overburdened. So Lord Krishna... Vishnu told, I'll be taking birth. The demigods will be coming there. So then Krishna killed a lot of demons. Obviously, the earth has been like relieved. But then it is mentioned that his own family, the Yadu dynasty, which supposedly they're not demons, also present a danger in the sense that they were so powerful. There was no one who could destroy them or kill them. And my understanding is that they were so good and close to the Lord, his own family members, you might wonder how they can cause chaos to the world.
How what?
Chaotic situation. Or how could they disturb the earth? But Krishna was considering, I have to do something to, you know, like, see, no one can kill them, I will create a situation in which they can kill themselves, the Yadu dynasty. So, and that happened. And in the 11th canto, it is mentioned in some purpose, some devotees, that even in the family of great sages and great devotees, Mahatmas, their own family members sometimes, they create disturbance, like in the case of Advaita Acharya, Nityananda. Prabhupada mentions the Nityananda Vamsa, and they were deviating. And even they mentioned Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was married twice, but he didn't have family, children. And then it's mentioned that our own Prabhupada, you know, his children, they were not that interested in, you know, following the principles as, you know, is expected. So this is like a reflection that I'm conveying, that even sometimes, you know, like you were mentioning, the demons were taking birth in powerful kings there to flourish. But also on the other side, you have that even the family members of the personality of Godhead or a great devotee, they also can represent some danger to the earth in that sense.
Yeah.
And sometimes I see that even in the material world, sometimes people, in order to prevent certain disturbances, you know, certain kings or leaders in certain countries, they only make that a leader should be like 6 months period and next one.
Yeah.
Four years period, next one. Because the tendency, the nature is to, You know,
yeah, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. So, yeah, I think I've heard this, but, somebody could correct me if they don't think it's accurate. I think I remember hearing something to the effect that Krishna was concerned that the Yadu dynasty, they were pious, you know, but still, even pious people, if they get too much material opulence, can go to your head, you know. And I think I remember hearing something to that effect, that Krishna was concerned that, you know, that it was they were going to get proud of their power and their opulence, and they could become adversely influenced by that and become a problem. I think I remember hearing, I know, once again, you know, somebody could... Right, so that is accurate. And Krishna arranged that because he was anticipating that possibly could happen, so let's take them all back. Yeah, okay.
And the innocent people will follow them. That's the problem, too. Because they say, oh, this is the family of Krishna, so what's wrong with that?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. The innocent people will just go along with, but actually it's not what Krishna was desiring from those people.
Yeah. Anybody else have anything they'd like to say? Okay, thank you very much. Krishna book, Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.